This is Car Expert.
If anyone's looking at a prestige vehicle for around 105 grand, drive a Macan, and tell me I'm wrong.
As the vehicle fleet grows into electric vehicles, how do you train new people and new technicians into something that's not quite here yet?
It's a pretty big task, but given the scale that Toyota works with and how proven and successful they've been over the last however many decades, I'm sure they'll be able to pull it off.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner. G'day to James Wong.
Hey, Mandy.
And Scott Colley, hello.
Hello, Mandy.
We're sort of winding up towards the end of the year with Christmas, and Car Expert had its Christmas party get together this week. And obviously the typical thing you do in a car publishing site, you go go-karting, right? It yeah. seems like the tradition. How did it go? Did any of you guys beat the legendary Paul Marek?
It sort of depends on who you ask. if you ask Igor, our videographer, it went really well. He brought his own helmet, so he was obliged to finish on the top step of the podium, and he did. He won in the overall rankings. Paul came in second, and then I came in third, and this is based on the aggregate of two races we did after qualifying.
You qualified?
We did a 10-minute qualifying and then a 10-lap and a 15-lap race. James actually out-qualified me, and then I squeezed him towards the edge of the track on lap one of the first race and got in front of him that way. And then in the second race, James was punted off the track viciously by Luca, our sales guy.
I just don't like, I'm surprised I didn't die. I had a very, very, very dramatic crash first lap of the second race, and because we decided to do a reverse grid, which sounded like a great idea, but then I had all the yobbos on my side of the track when I was going around the first lap, and we had a couple, one, our second videographer and then our Victorian sales manager tussling for, I think, fourth at the time, and I was like, oh, I'll do the smart thing and I'll try to go around the outside and get around them. Little did I know that they would have quite a hard collision, which then bumped one of them into me. It was almost like bumper cars, and it just sent me literally flying off the track. So I got airborne, hit the ground hard, and just smashed into the colorful barriers like it was a bowling alley. And I had to wait for the young kid. It's really funny, but I was quite distressed. And then I had to wait for the young attendant to run from the complete opposite side of the track while everyone lapped me twice. So,
driving past, I was hot on the heels of Paul, and then we were following close behind Sean, who's the videographer that James was talking about. And all of a sudden, Sean put his hand up, and then Paul put his hand up as well, and we started slowing down. And it looked like James was buried in a ditch or something. There was sort of barriers scattered everywhere and cart back wheel up in the air. There was no damage to the cart or anything like that. It was fine, but it did look very dramatic, and James did well to claw his way back from there to fifth.
Wow. Well,
I came fifth overall. I think in that second race, my actual ranking was second last. I managed to unlap myself and get past Will Stopford, which I don't,
our expert speed bump extraordinaire.
Yeah, I don't know how much of an achievement that was, given that's where he was for the other two races as well. But it was a lot of fun. I actually set the third best lap time in two of the three races. So wow. I am proud of myself for at least achieving something. And I think by that point, I was just focused on trying to have a good time and not worry about the positions, because even though I managed to finish middle of the pack despite all the odds, it was still a very fun day. So I don't like to talk about it too much because it brings back traumatic memories. Because I was quite concerned for a second because I had no chance to brake before I actually hit the wall, because half of it was airborne. And then before I knew it, I was in the grass and into the barriers. So there was a moment there where I was like, I really am going a bit quick here. I don't know if I hit the wall, whether I'm going to be okay.
Anyway, if you're from a car brand and you're listening, we're a very responsible bunch. Please give us all of your expensive fast cars to drive.
Just don't give them to James Wong, right?
As long as Sean and Luca aren't around, I think James is fine.
Yeah, exactly. This is the thing. It was not my fault. And this is something that I actually said. This is a bit of a tangent, but this is normally what I say to people who are buying new cars or thinking of buying a very old used car. And I'm like, no, it's not just about how safe you are. It's about other people on the road. And this was the prime example. You can end up in a three-car pileup and be injured and have done nothing wrong at all.
So were there prizes?
So Igor won the cheapest trophy money can buy.
right.
But he still got it proudly displayed on his on his desk at the office now. And then Paul and I came away with Ace Carts hats, but also the pride of knowing that we were on the podium. There's a photo of us, Igor and I, looking happy and Paul looking annoyed that he didn't beat Igor. So we'll post that in the podcast post as well. But, yeah, that was probably the biggest prize of all, upsetting marriage.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, Igor was pretty hard to beat with the go-karting, so good on him.
As someone who doesn't really fit in a go-kart and tips the scales at, we'll call it triple figures, just, I watch Igor and he knows his way around the track, but I also watch him accelerate away sometimes and go, I wish I was about 40 kilos lighter. It's a bit frustrating that he knows what he's doing and weighs nothing.
Just imagine how much you would have won by if you weighed nothing.
Well, this is what I keep telling people and they don't believe me. I'm basically Max Verstappen. I'm just 6'7". I'm not Dutch. I can't drive an F1 car.
Hey, speaking of, wow, I know we don't talk too much about F1s on the podcast, but big stuff happened this week. Did you guys actually watch it unfold?
I didn't watch it live. Yeah. I was, we'll call it tired and not hungover, but I did try to stay up and then there was other stuff going on Monday that I needed to be switched on for, so I didn't make it. I woke up early on Monday morning and watched it and yeah, it was absolutely crazy. I'm happy with the result. I don't feel particularly strongly either way about Lewis or Max, but it's good to see someone new standing on top of the podium. But yeah, the chaos of that last few laps was like nothing I've ever seen in motor racing. They're sort of making it up as they go a little bit, it seems like.
Yeah. Which side do you agree with? Do you think Hamilton was perhaps a little bit unlucky?
I think he was a little bit unlucky, but then I also distinctly remember him winning his first world title on the back of Timo Glock stranded on the last corner in Brazil. And, you know, he's won 7 of them. He's had some luck go his way. I know this was pretty overt and very hard to blame anything else, but at some point the luck has to turn, and Max was good enough once his car was in a spot to win it that he actually managed to execute. So
yeah,
Lewis was definitely unlucky, and I mean if I were Mercedes, I'd also be angrily making German calls to the boss. But all things being equal, I mean, Hamilton still had the chance to pit at the start of the safety car and he still had the chance to defend, and Verstappen was good enough to get past him. So I don't know, as a spectacle it was pretty cool.
It was, yeah. Okay, let's get into this week's car news. Over to you, J-Wo. This is incredible. Toyota has released 16 new EV concepts and has going to accelerate their battery EV sales target.
Yeah, so this was a really interesting announcement because there was just like a calendar entry, and I think the guys thought, oh, you know, it's just going to be the Toyota boss getting out and saying something or whatever. I don't think we really realized how big this announcement was going to be. So, yeah, Toyota has pledged 30 battery electric models globally by 2030 in the passenger and commercial segments, and that's beyond the 15 electric vehicles by 2025 it pledged earlier this year. There are 16 electric concept cars that were revealed during this presentation that cover both the Toyota and Lexus brands, sort of giving us an insight into what the lineup might look like in the next 10 years or so. So that if you go to carexpert.com.au, there's quite a few pictures of all the different cars sort of lined up together. I'm amazed at how they're just out of nowhere these things have materialized, but you can sort of see some very direct links to some existing and past Toyota Lexus models. We've seen some of like the autonomous buses, which I think that's one of them in the corner there.
The E-Palette, I think that one's called.
Yeah, the one that was meant to be for the Tokyo Olympics. Then there's a few other ones that are, you know, you've got the BZ4X. Is that what it's called?
That is what it's called, yes.
I don't do code, so I need to – I always forget how to do it. But then there's a couple here. There's one that looks like a Prius successor. There's one that looks like a Yaris Cross or an Aygo X or whatever that little tiny SUV is overseas. And then there's a couple of Lexus sports cars that are really interesting too. One of them that sort of looks like an LFA made love to a McLaren and a Supra. It was, yeah. So I digress a little bit. So Toyota says that it now expects annual battery electric vehicle sales of 3.5 million cars by 2030, which is equal to about a third of its annual output based on current numbers. And that's up from the 2 million unit target that it announced in May this year. So really interesting news out of that event. They have a couple of other interesting concepts there. So there's one that sort of looks like a reborn FJ Cruiser and the Tacoma, right?
Yeah.
The Ute. Yeah, so it's pretty cool that they're doing this. And I guess Toyota, even though it sort of led the electrification movement some 20 years ago or with the first Prius, and it has really pushed the hybrid tech, it's been a bit slow to move into full electric vehicle worlds like some of the European brands have. So I'd be really interested to know both of your thoughts on this, because obviously they're focused, they're saying global. Before you guys add your thoughts, the Lexus will be entirely electric by 2035 globally, and it will be all electric in Europe, North America, and China before 2030. So they're really, really accelerating these plans. When you think about it, 10 years or 9 or 8 at this point is not really a long time to completely overhaul your lineup and go develop all these new technologies. So it's a pretty big task, but given the scale that Toyota works with and how efficient they've been and proven and successful they've been over the last however many decades, I'm sure they'll be able to pull it off.
Toyota is known for being quite a conservative company, and the way that it's moved with hybrids and even new technologies like Apple CarPlay and Android Auto sort of show that. They tend to test and test and test and wait for a technology to be completely ready and then roll it out 100% from day one. So it wasn't surprising, but it was disappointing that it wasn't committing to electric cars in the way that a lot of its rivals were. I think the fact that it has now committed to a huge, almost doubling of its sales targets by 2030 has been partly driven by government incentives around the world and government pledges to kill internal combustion sales. But I think also that no brand is bigger than, you know, the public opinion. And as the world is moving to electric cars, being seen as lagging behind or not having the technology is really, really dangerous. So it must have taken something pretty significant internally for Toyota to go back and look at the plan that announced earlier this year and completely rework it. But it's going to be really interesting to see how Toyota does roll out these electric cars and what impact it has on the industry, given its scale.
Did we know, have any inkling that these concepts were coming? I don't remember seeing any leaked photos. All of a sudden, bam, there's 16 concepts.
So a couple of them we've seen like patent renderings of, or there's been rumors of new models, especially on the Lexus side of things. But generally, there'll be a protracted teaser campaign and all sorts of things. This was literally, we just thought it was an update on battery development, was the way that we were pitched whatever was happening. And Mike sat down at about 7 o'clock on Wednesday night or Tuesday night to write it. And came away with about 8 stories, and it was all the most urgent thing in the world because Toyota just dumped it like that. So a really big announcement with very little warning.
I think another thing to add there is that, you know, the Japanese brands in particular have long been quite conservative in terms of investments and things like that as well. They're not ones to really completely change their way of working and just dumping money on stuff. But some of the budgets that they've mentioned in this presentation are quite interesting as well. So Toyota's committed a further 500 billion yen, which works out to about $6.2 billion, into more advanced, high-quality and affordable batteries within the same period, working towards those 2030 and 2035 targets. And the battery budget by the end of this decade is just under $25 billion, or the equivalent of. And then that's also within an overall 4 trillion yen, or $49.4 billion, that Toyota plans to put into research and development for specifically for electric cars by the end of the 2020s. And that excludes hybrids and hydrogen vehicles. So the money at play here. Now, obviously, Toyota is one of the richest companies in the world and one of the biggest, especially in the automotive space. But, you know, after the global financial crisis a decade or two ago, the Japanese brands have sort of been very limited in their investment. We're seeing them being quite conservative and sort of playing it safe. And I think this is one of, like Scott said, this could really change the course of the industry, because Toyota being such a global brand and having such an impact in a lot of markets, this could really change public perception of electric vehicles, because, you know, we've seen how hybrid has changed just in Australia with things like RAV4, Camry, New Kluger and so on. If they can start doing something similar but with electric vehicles in the next 5 to 10 years, who knows, maybe we'll see the rates of electric sales just overturn as well, because at the moment you're only really seeing Tesla and some of the other brands do a little bit, but not quite the scale that we're seeing in other parts of the world. So really interesting stuff, and I'm keen to see how this sort of turns out over the next decade or so.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, we're going to look ahead to only 2 years away once we hit the new year. I'm going to talk a little bit more about government and another pledge with VACC CEO shortly. But, Scully, government could make self-steering mandatory on new cars from 2024. This is going to be very welcome.
It is a good idea, I think. We've seen this happen before with AEB, and other nations have mandated things like reversing cameras, seatbelt warnings over the years. So it's not unheard of. This wouldn't be the first time that the Australian government has mandated technology like this, and it also wouldn't be the first time it's been done globally. Things like reversing cameras, parking sensors, seatbelt warnings are mandatory in different parts of the world. But the logic behind this is that lane keeping assist, so if you drift towards the edge of your lane, a system that will steer the car back into it, is very, very valuable for saving lives and stopping crashes on rural roads in areas where people falling asleep is a problem. At the moment, only about 61% of light vehicles are actually fitted with the technology, and you need to have it for a maximum ANCAP score. So it's already being pushed towards, but by actually making it mandatory, the theory is that everything will have it and you can save lives on the road. The proposal is a federal one, and it's down under Australian Design Rule 107/00, which is very catchy, and it's modelled on a European Union restriction. If it is adopted, all light passenger and commercial vehicles up to 3.5 tonnes, so essentially anything we cover in VFACTS, will need to have the system, and it'll apply to all new cars that are introduced after that 2024 date. And then every vehicle being sold in Australia from March 2026. So there is always a bit of overlap there so that the fleet doesn't get left behind. I don't think there's much more to talk about here, really. It's not unusual for a government to try to push safety standards, and it's something that ANCAP does by only offering a 5-star rating. But ANCAP isn't a government body. Ultimately, it is an independent crash tester, and it doesn't have the right to mandate rules. So this sort of goes a step further and is an attempt to make car makers fit their cars with this stuff, because although sometimes we like to complain about lane keeping assist systems getting a little bit grabby on the wheel and sometimes the tech can be annoying, ultimately in the long run it does save lives, especially somewhere in Australia where people spend a lot of time on country highways and drowsy driving is a problem and that sort of thing.
It's going to make luxury brands sort of step up as well, because you find the more expensive a car is, the less gear it has sometimes, and these sort of safety features don't really come standard. So we might see a flip with that.
It'll be interesting.
Yeah, it certainly will. J-Wo, GM Australia wants Holden fans to, quote, come on the journey because Chevy sales are spiking.
Yes. So Mike Costello joined the GMSV team on an open day recently, and they had a few things to say. They're experiencing a lot of success at the moment. They've already sold more than 2,100 of their Silverados that they convert to right-hand drive in Melbourne Southeast, and that's across Australia and New Zealand. But that's a big number when you consider that they're all over $100,000. And GMSV has also sold out its initial allocation of the C8 Corvette, which in its first allocation is around 228 vehicles. So that's another, 200 and something, $170,000 supercars that are probably $200,000 once they hit the road. So they're experiencing a lot of success, and I guess that now that Holden's gone and, they were for a long time they were promising like a V8 sports car and all this kind of thing, they're sort of delivering on that promise from a few years ago. But it's also in spite of the recent coverage that has seen GM get criticized by various people and bodies about the treatment of dealers and customers and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, so GMSV is sort of trying to separate itself from the Holden saga and present itself as a new entity, but also trying to appeal to those people that were really big fans of Holden and General Motors in general.
I think the thing that GMSV does have in its favour is that, for one, it's not trying to be a volume brand. And there are a lot of people at home who might have owned Commodores that will never consider a Corvette or a Silverado. GMSV doesn't need to win them over. It also is working with so few cars that, of course, there are 250 people in Australia that want a Corvette. There's probably more than that. So as a starting point, I think it's probably off to a good start. But longer term, these are the sort of brand perceptions that can really hurt and make it hard to build a new operation. Recently, GM has been bashed by the ACCC for its treatment of Australian Holden dealers when it left. Even after wrapping up the investigation and the findings not necessarily being 100% as expected, the ACCC is still looking into GM dropping its lifetime cap price servicing, and a Senate inquiry criticised General Motors for its treatment of the local dealers. There's still court cases going on between Holden sales operations and GM as well. So once we get beyond the initial excitement of Corvette and Silverado, and once people start to wrap their head around the fact that this company is still the company or a version of it that was selling Holden, left and is now coming back, that's when this sort of image problem may come to it. And it just seems like GMSV is trying to get on the front foot and sort of build its own legacy. But that is obviously tough in a country where Holden's been present for, you know, the majority of the time Australia's been Australia.
True. And we're going to finish on another car that's doing quite well. Scully, you used to own one of these, the 2022 Subaru BRZ, sold out.
It sure is. Subaru had a very limited allocation to start with. There are only 500 of them coming into the country, and they are all gone. We don't know when the next allocation will arrive, nor how many cars it'll have. But it just goes to show there's still demand for sports cars at an affordable price, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Having owned a previous BRZ, a lot of what is new about this car really excites me. Subaru has upped the power and the torque, and we've talked about this on the podcast before. It also has some stuff in there designed to settle the handling down a little bit without sort of undermining the fact that it's a fun and lively rear-wheel drive car. We're actually driving the BRZ early next year as well. And I say we are at this stage, I am, which is very exciting. So,
does the boss know yet?
Yeah, the boss does know, thankfully. I'm not trying to spring this on him. It's not unusual for a sports car like this to sell out its initial allocation. We saw it with the previous BRZ and with the GR86, the Toyota GT86 at the time. When they first launch, pent-up demand for these cars means they sell really quickly because enthusiasts know what they are and they know what they want and they are willing to put their money down on it. The challenge with cars like this is usually maintaining that level of sales success because once all the people who know what they are have bought one, it's not like there's a ton of people out there trading in the RAV4 for a BRZ. So it's also not unusual or shocking to see this happen, even in times when supply is better, but it does bode well for Subaru and show that affordable sports cars are still a thing. I'm also curious, guys, would you go for something like a BRZ or a GR86, or do you think maybe you're more Fiesta ST, Hyundai i20N sort of people?
No. I'll let Mandy go first.
I'm one of those ones who like to fall into a car, into the driver's seat, and then have to climb out of it. And I want to sit as low to the road as possible. So now I would look over, Fiesta ST and go for something like, the BRZ. What about you, Joe?
I think I need to probably get a better understanding of the stuff that's included in them and get more of a feel for what the cabin's like and all that kind of thing. Because like you say, Mandy, the getting in and out of the car is a big part of it because that's where you spend your time. And my previous experience with BRZ and 86 with the previous generation was that, they're a lot of fun, but I guess for me as a daily driver, I probably prefer something that's a bit more refined. I know these new generation models are going to be a lot better with that and the tech in them is much better. But I think that also given the packaging and normally with like a sports coupe, you're somewhat compromised in various areas. As a Golf GTI owner, it is very comforting to know that regardless of whether I need to carry four people, a weekend's worth of luggage or, you know, drive to the city or go out into the country on course chip roads, that I'm always going to be comfortable and happy driving it. I'd probably need to get a try of this new BRZ or new 86 to gauge whether it's possible in the new version of this, because the old ones were very loud and very raw, which to some people that really appeals, and that's it does what it says on the tin. For someone like me, though, I like the nicer things in life, and it's not necessarily something I would personally put my money down on, because I feel like I'm someone that likes to be very pragmatic. I think of every possible situation that I could be faced with if I'm using a car like that. So, that would sort of play
into the decision, but I wouldn't make a call right now purely because I haven't seen or driven the new ones yet. They could really surprise me and be a ball of fun. But I also love the MX-5, which in concept is pretty similar. So
it is, yeah. Yep. I'm actually sort of glad when I was looking at buying my new daily driver, I didn't go down the MX-5 route because I wanted one. But I was the same as you. In the end, I'm like, I've got to think about practicality here. It's only a two-seater. There's nothing behind those two seats.
Which is why you bought the bastion of practicality that is the Volkswagen Up.
One of the world's most tiniest cars, but it's surprisingly practical. Right, that's it for news. Head to the site if you'd like to know more. Prime Minister Scott Morrison has a plan, and that is to have 1.7 million zero and low emissions vehicles on our roads by 2030. And while that sounds like a good plan, the Victorian Automotive Chamber of Commerce, the VACC for short, thinks the government is not quite ready. To find out why, we are joined by the VACC CEO, Jeff Gwillem. Always a pleasure to have you on, Jeff, and thanks for your time.
It's a pleasure, and thank you for the invitation.
There is no doubt the VACC would support this government pledge, but you've recently discovered some holes. Can you take us through it?
Well, there are a few holes, but I think it's important to say that the automotive industry nationally and actually internationally as well welcomes new technology, things like electric vehicles. They're exciting. They're great pieces of machinery. So I think it's important that people understand that we've got an industry that's forward-looking, but we've got a whole lot of change that's about to occur. So the governments around the world have made different statements about 2025, 2030, 2035, moving to electric vehicle fleets. In most cases, they are statements by prime ministers or leaders of countries that don't have a lot of thought about how that's actually going to happen. And in Australia, of course, we've got governments, state governments and federal government talking about 50% of all new vehicles that are purchased in 2030 being electric. So, for instance, that means in 2030, you know, we sell 1.1 million vehicles a year in Australia. That means you've got a growing vehicle fleet, but in that year alone, 500,000 vehicles are going to be electric. The thing that's missing in Australia and globally, by the way, and I can talk about some of our conversations internationally, is the technicians that we need to actually keep these vehicles on the road.
Okay. So that's basically you're saying that there's not going to be enough technicians by 2030 to look after these cars.
Well, we've got a furtive gentleman here called Steve Bletsos, who's a senior research analyst at the VACC. This guy gets up in the morning and eats numbers and sort of lives in that whole world of number crunching and you know, analysis. And he set himself to work recently, because we keep talking about electric vehicles, he started to look at the data and the numbers in terms of the numbers of apprentices that go through every year and what the shortage would be. And his analysis, and as a matter of fact, I think it's conservative, but his analysis says that in 2030, we'll have 1.7 million electric vehicles in the fleet in Australia, and we'll have a shortage of 6,000 technicians.
Jeff, we already have quite a well-trained workforce of mechanics who are experienced with petrol and diesel vehicles. What scope is there to retrain those mechanics, and what work's being done to get them ready for more hybrid and then more electric vehicles? Because presumably they also have a big role to play.
Yeah. The answer to that question is not a lot, and I'll provide a bit more fabric around that. So we've been having conversations with Sweden and Denmark and Germany and the UK about what's happened in their vehicle fleets. As we know, Norway has got over 50% of the cars sold in Norway are electric now. They've put billions of dollars in out of their oil fund to help subsidise people across into electric cars. And even in Norway, we know that things like the infrastructure isn't as good as it could be. We know that a whole lot of technicians that were in the industry as these vehicles came through didn't transition across into electric vehicles. And as a matter of fact, the point they made to us is that most of the traditional internal combustion engine mechanics just stayed doing that. And younger and new technicians that came in actually started to service the electric vehicle fleet. Now, that doesn't mean that that would occur in every country. But in Australia, if you look at the automotive industry, it's a pretty aging workforce. My feeling would be that there's a whole lot of people out there that are 50 plus years old, and they would be having a view, and I've heard some of them say it, so I can put my hand on my heart. They would have a view, look, I'm going to continue working on the internal combustion engine stuff. I'll be okay. I'm going to finish in 10 years. I'm going to move through. So that's part of the problem is we've already got an aging workforce in automotive. Got a lot of baby boomers that will be going out in the next 5 to 10 years. And we don't have enough young people coming through that are going to pick up a new qualification. Now, here's the real catch. And even, you know, I was going to say even I, but even we don't have a solution to this. This is the challenge of electric vehicles. You've got hybrid vehicles coming through now, conventional hybrid and plug-in hybrids. They've got batteries in, and we've got technicians working on these vehicles right now that are working on the petrol, the diesel side, and in some cases they're doing some work on the motors or in and around the charging systems. As the vehicle fleet grows into electric vehicles, how do you train a whole lot of, let's just talk about new people and new technicians, how do you train them into something that's not quite here yet? So if you go inside a TAFE Institute or a private training provider, they sort of run on a 13 or a 20 to 1 group size, 13 students or 20 students and one teacher, and it's costed around in a particular model, whether it's funded by the state or privately funded by the employer. When you've got an emerging technology coming through, we need the government to fund what we call thin markets, thin training markets. So we might have an institute that says, well, I've got 4 people that want to do this qualification in electric vehicles, but I can't get funding to deliver this until I get to 20. Well, that might take 2 years to happen. So we need the governments to be able to fund, these are called thin delivery areas in TAFE talk, if you like, to fund thin delivery areas so that we can start to get kids coming through in small groups that start to become fully rounded technicians. Now, there is a new qualification inside the training package for automotive, and it's just going through the final stages of endorsement. That is a standalone automotive industry qualification for electric vehicle technicians. I can tell you right now, today, 16th of December, 2021, there is not one student in Australia undertaking an apprenticeship as an electric vehicle technician.
What about on the manufacturer side? I know a lot of car makers or OEMs have their own academies for training mechanics and apprentices. Mm. Are you working with them, and have they picked up some of the slack that maybe you feel government should to try to get people trained up for the transition?
Okay. So some manufacturers provide some training. Normally that training is delivered directly to the dealership network. That's fine. That's that arrangement. Seldomly does a car manufacturer deliver technology training outside of their dealership network. Now, you might get an aftermarket organisation, a Bosch, that says, well, we're going to step in here and we're going to provide some training, but that will be about componentry training generally, not about whole of systems training. In automotive, what normally happens is technology changes on a vehicle that bleeds its way through the dealership environment and actually then comes out into aftermarket and independent repairers over time. I don't think we're going to have time for that to happen on this occasion, because even though in Australia today there might be a pool of 25,000 electric vehicles across the whole fleet, my gut feeling is based on what you can see in the press and, you know, what's coming through the media, is that we will have a high incline in electric vehicles coming to Australia over the next 2 or 3 years. And that's where we're going to get caught flat-footed, where there's a whole volume of vehicles coming through and we don't have these people that are ready and waiting. So there's a huge amount of work to do culturally in Australia around getting parents to readjust their thinking around trades and automotive trades in particular. Because if we don't, we're going to run out of people. And if we run out of people, two things happen. Things get more expensive and you wait longer for them. They're the two things that happen.
We're already waiting longer for cars at the moment. We just need to get worse.
We are waiting longer for cars, yeah.
Yeah, there's still so many questions that need to be answered. VACC CEO Jeff Gwillim, been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much indeed.
Less is more when it comes to the styling of the 2022 Honda Civic, but as we've previously discussed on the Car Expert podcast, perhaps the same cannot be said for its pricing. Scully, you've had the chance to spend some time with this car, and Joe has driven it as well. Do you think the Civic will survive the price hike in Australia, given the brand's low volume sales at the moment?
So I am not – I'm going to do my best car brand executive impression here and say that I'm not willing to comment on future product. What I will say is I think Honda is being realistic, expecting to sell fewer than 1,000 of these every year because it is a very nice car, but 47,200 drive away I think is still too much money for it, especially when you consider there's no entry-level model to entice people through the doors of the showroom.
Okay, so do you at least get a decent amount of kit for your money?
You do. So the Civic, for one, has always been has recently been one of the bigger cars in the hatchback class, and that's the same here. It's a couple of hundred mil longer than a Golf hatchback, and that plays out with a body that is big and looks really nice and elegant, but also with an interior that's really spacious. In terms of standard equipment, it gets almost everything that you would expect. It gets 18-inch alloys, dual-zone climate, automatic LED headlights, all that stuff. It's also got wireless CarPlay and factory sat-nav and a much better infotainment system, which we'll get to. It misses out on some stuff as well, though. There's no sunroof at 47,200, and there's also no fully digital instrument cluster, which, having done some sleuthing – actually, I say that. Having done some sleuthing on the Honda Japan website is an option in Japan. So – pretty much everything you would expect of a car around this price is standard, but it's still missing out on a couple of things that you would need to have if you were going to say, yes, 47,200 is good value.
I don't mind the new styling of it. It is much less than what the previous gen was. I still don't know about that front part of it, though. What are your thoughts?
I think it looks really good in person. We actually picked it up from a Honda center in Springvale, and they had it parked next to a previous gen car in the same color. And looking at them side by side, there's just absolutely no contest. The new one is so much cleaner and it looks lower and wider. So there are some awkward lines in photos, the bonnet cut line and the grill and that sort of thing. In person, it looks really good. And I think Honda's done an awesome job evolving it to the point where it still looks like a Civic, but it shares very little with the previous car. I think also the car we get in Australia is spec'd really nicely. It's on 18-inch wheels, and the four colours you can get all work well with the dark grille treatment and the dark wheels. So maybe as a base model it might look a little bit awkward, but in reality it looks like a bigger car. It could almost be an Accord from some angles, which is a good thing.
True. Does it come with a new engine, or is it much the same?
So it's a 1.5-litre turbocharged engine, which is the same basic configuration as the last car. It's got slightly more torque. It's got 240 newton metres instead of 220 newton metres, but power is down from 133 to 131 kilowatts. In reality, that makes absolutely no difference, the power anyway. You feel the extra torque when you're driving. It's still CVT only in Australia, which is still disappointing because in the US you can get a Civic Si, and it's like a warm hatch or a warm sedan with a manual transmission, and we'd love to get that here. But the CVT has also seen some changes that really improve it in day-to-day driving. It feels really nice and linear off the mark, and when you put your foot down, it doesn't do that annoying CVT thing where it sits at one noisy set of revs and just stays there. You hit past what would be the kickdown point in a normal transmission, and it actually just revs all the way out to the red line and then does a fake upshift. So there's been some really good changes there. I think the last thing worth mentioning on that front is that in Australia we now get start-stop, and it works really nice and smoothly, which makes driving the car in traffic far more efficient, because if anyone's tried to drive in Melbourne recently, it's really hard to get anywhere without spending hours sitting at the lights or sitting in traffic, and having start-stop that works really smoothly saves you fuel but also makes it a quieter and smoother place to be.
Well, that was going to be my next question. How is the ride? Is it nice and smooth out in the open road?
The previous gen car, even though it wasn't quite as highly spec'd as this one, felt very grown up. It's got quite a long wheelbase and, you know, a wide track compared to a lot of other cars in the class. This version here has a longer wheelbase again than the last Civic, and it's got a wider rear track too. And that means that it just feels a little bit bigger and a little bit more planted. The ride is not super sort of cushy and supple. You definitely feel things in the road, but it's never like harsh is the word that I would use. So you hit speed bumps and potholes and things, and you definitely are aware that you've hit something, but the body is really nicely controlled and it takes that little edge off it. It feels almost sporty without being overtly sporty, which given Honda is known for cars like the Accord Euro and going back further, the Integra and the Civic Type R and that sort of thing, is a trait that a lot of Honda owners will really like. It's very smooth and very quiet at normal city speeds as well. That engine you barely know is there most of the time, to the point where I didn't even realize the start-stop hadn't kicked in at one point because it was just idling so smoothly. And that's something that Honda put a real focus on with this car. As you get to highway speeds, it's not quite as quiet. The engine's still really settled. It's got adaptive cruise, so you can just let it do its thing and it sits at low revs. But despite the extra sound deadening and the bits and pieces Honda have done to improve the refinement, there's a lot of tyre roar on Australian highways, and not even really terrible coarse chip country highways, but some more, call it mundane stuff. Out the back of Healesville and on the Eastern Freeway coming back, there are a couple of sections where you really need to turn up the Bose stereo to drown it out. And that's a little bit disappointing because Honda said that it was something it focused on. And if it wants to sell the car for 47 grand drive away, it really needs to be a bit more premium than the last one. And that doesn't quite stack up with the rest of the driving experience.
Okay, so we might step inside the car now. Is the cabin a step up, and can you touch on a little bit more about the infotainment system?
So the cabin is a huge step up. The last car was very spacious and had some cool ideas, but it also had a lot of odd angles and hard plastics. The new one has like an almost retro design. It's got this horizontal air vent that runs across the dashboard with like hexagonal metal lattice.
I called it chicken wire.
James called it chicken wire, and we were going to hang some Christmas baubles from it, but we didn't in the end. It's love or hate. I actually think it looks really, really cool. It's a clean retro design touch that shows Honda is aware of its heritage and also shows that maybe the angular, very futuristic design language it was taking before has finally reached its zenith. You know, they're not going to go down that path anymore. In terms of the quality, it feels pretty good. The seats are lovely suede and leather units, and they're heated. There's red stitching throughout. There's a nice soft armrest. And the infotainment system is a massive step forward. The last Civic had a system that felt like a Game Boy Color. It was slow to respond. It had really blocky graphics. The cameras looked like they were going for like an 80s adult film soft focus effect.
Wow.
It just wasn't up to scratch. The new infotainment system is really quick. It's got really colourful, bright graphics. It's got proper mapping, not a system that looks aftermarket. And the cameras are all top-notch. So everything that we've complained about in the last Civic seems to have been addressed on that front. It also gets wireless CarPlay and wireless phone charging, which were both missing from the previous car and both fit in with a car that is priced around that $50,000 mark. In terms of taking on a car like the Golf R or even the Skoda Octavia, the previous one couldn't have really come close on the tech front. The new one now mostly has the tools to do that. The only area it doesn't is with the digital instrument cluster, which is nice but doesn't add a ton of functionality beyond what you just get from normal dials, because realistically it just always ends up being a speedo and a rev counter with something inside the rev counter, and that's a little bit disappointing at this price. Down back, there's a ton of space. It's got lots of headroom, lots of legroom. And the boot has more than 400 litres of space. They've taken out the spare wheel, which is a bit disappointing, but it does mean you get a really spacious spot under the floor, and the boot itself is so low and so wide. If you want a car that's not massive but still want to carry stuff around or fold the seats down and put bikes in, it's the best in the business on that front.
Fantastic. I suppose Honda is doing a really good thing. I know that their prices have sort of upped a little bit, but their servicing prices aren't too bad.
Yeah, so part of the switch to the new Honda agency model is that every single one of its cars has fixed price services, and they're $125 each for the first 5 years. The only caveat on that is you've got to go to the dealer every 12 months or 10,000 Ks and not 15,000 Ks like some of its rivals. Even that aside, we've always said Toyota's doing a good thing by having $199 services fixed. $125 is really cheap, and if you are laying down the money for this car, you would expect really good quality service. Knowing that it's going to cost you I'm not a maths genius, but $625 to service over 5 years is really nice peace of mind, and it goes some way to justifying that premium-ish price.
Yeah. All right, you've given the Honda Civic a 7.8 Car Expert rating. That review is live now. Time to welcome back Mr. Porsche himself, Tony Crawford. Hello.
Hello. Well, I've just sold my Porsche, so I can officially to bloody Doncaster Porsche or somewhere.
I'll go and have a look at it in the showroom. I live around the corner from that one.
I'll pick it up next week. I think I've just got to fill out the paperwork. But
wow, so they bought a Sydney car.
Yeah, I'm actually, yeah, they bought my car. They probably put 200 grand on it, which will piss me off, but that's okay. It's all in the interest of heading towards a GT3. So I've got to look at the bigger picture here.
Don't go and spend it on something else before you find that GT3.
No, that's right. It's something I need to rein in spending.
All right, so we've got you on to talk about the Porsche Macan this week. Before we dig into that review, I'm really keen to find out what your thoughts are on sports car brands jumping onto the SUV bandwagon like Porsche has.
Well, in Porsche's case, it virtually that and the Cayenne saved the company from extinction. So you can't blame them. And, you know, like, you know, whether you're rich or whether you're middle class, you know, the SUV craze has bitten everyone. And, you know, I guess I can understand it. I was sitting in a very low car the other day and I had this SUV in front of me and I couldn't see a freaking thing. Like, I'm just blind to what's happening in front of me. And I'm wondering if this guy's going so slow or he's left a 10-car gap. And I'm thinking, will you hurry that, you know, F up? And you know, had I been in an SUV, I could see what was happening in front of me. So I do get the fact that people do now, but there's so many of them. It's like you can't beat them, join them. And, you know, we're in this. I really hope this, I can't call it a fad, but this generation of SUV drivers finishes at some stage and we go back to driving normally well-tuned cars that perform and handle better than these high-riding heavy SUVs. Mm. It's just another story, I guess. But
hashtag bring back the wagon.
Yeah, 100%.
All right. So what's changed for the 2022 Porsche Macan?
Not much. Not much at all. You'd have to be an aficionado or someone that works for Porsche or a motoring journalist to pick up on the changes outside. Really, they're incidental. There's a bit more. There's a black grill base on the GDS. There's a little bit more air intake on the front. There's slightly different rear end with a different diffuser. But apart from that, it's basically the same. The changes, or the most noticeable changes inside the cabin, where you've lost all the hard buttons on the Porsche's great center console, that flight deck looking center console, and you've now got a very neat flat screen with haptic buttons. So there's still quite a few buttons there, but they're haptic and they're not visible. So they're not hard buttons, as we like to call them. And I've got to say, it does look better. And I'm pretty much, I love hard buttons, but I'm pretty used to this very, very quickly. After about 10 minutes, I'm thinking, yeah, this is better. 100%. So, yeah, I like it. Different steering wheel from a 911. So they've got a range of 911 steering wheels. The entry-level Macan, which is about 89 grand plus on roads, has the only difference between that and the Macan S and the now top of the range, the GTS, used to be the turbo, that'll probably come at some stage, doesn't have the drive mode switch or the dial, the rotary dial. So that's on the S and the GTS, but not the Macan, stock Macan, which it's called now. But at $89,000, it's a pretty good bargain when you look at it against its more pricey competition from BMW and Mercedes-Benz and Audi, for that matter. But certainly Mercedes and BMW are pricier for the performance. And then you jump to the Macan S. So we actually drove the Macan S first, wrongly or rightly, and the people that drove with me, we all agreed that after we'd driven all of them, that this was by far the sweet spot for about 105 grand, 104 grand plus on roads. Not many options. Unlike the past, Porsche, like every other manufacturer in the premium segment, has had to fit out their cars with more equipment, more luxurious equipment, so that the options, which are still plentiful on Porsche, I might add, you could not look at an options list and be quite happy with the standard spec. That's what I want to say. Unless you particularly like special stitching and color matched stitching and all that sort of stuff. But look, this car, I hadn't driven a Macan till I went on in 2019 or late 18, actually. I was in Malaga or Corsica or one of those countries, and we were driving the updated Macan. And so it had been a long time since I'd been in a Macan, and I'd kind of thought, you know, there's got to be, maybe there's better SUVs in the premium. Maybe BMW have got some good stuff in the X3. But I tell you what, after about 2 hours in this car, what strikes me most is the way this car feels like you're driving a Porsche. And they've really nailed it, and they always have. But now, I don't know what they've done with the suspension, but this is some of the finest suspension tuning engineering that you'll ever get on an SUV. And it makes me think that 89 grand, which is already cheap, and all the prices are already cheaper than their rival performance-based rivals, but the ride handling balance is so superior to its rivals that it puts it in another league. And, you know, we weren't mucking around on these very deserted B roads in regional New South Wales. And this thing is extraordinary for the way it handles and the way it rides when you want it to ride. And, of course, adaptive suspension on the Macan S and GDS. In fact, adaptive air suspension on the GDS, adaptive suspension dampers on the Macan S, and fixed rate setup on the Macan. But that's pretty good too. I can't knock the Macan with its fixed rate springs and dampers. It's damn good. And again, for 89 grand, I would be absolutely influencing friends and family, if they wanted a prestige vehicle, to go with the Porsche. Because I think having a Porsche badge and a Porsche key, as opposed to other German rivals, is, for me, it's got more cachet.
Crawf, this is a facelifted version of a facelifted version of the original Macan.
That's right.
Does it feel meaningfully different to that first generation or first facelift car, or does it still just feel like a gentle evolution? Because it's been around for quite a while now.
Yeah, I think what you just said, it's very evolutionary. And what I want to say is I don't think there was much to change, Scott. This car was already, for me, a segment leader. Look, people could argue that the SQ5 at around the same coin offers more in the base than a Macan S, but I'd argue that I think having a Porsche keyring is far more delectable than having an Audi, even though they're the same company, right? So we're arguing apples with apples here, but give me the Macan. I think it has a better ride handling balance. I think the engineering's more sophisticated, and this is a car that crushes bumps at the same time of tucking into a corner as you would on track. It's extraordinary. It really is. If anyone's looking at a prestige vehicle for around 105 grand, you go straight to the Porsche dealership and drive a Macan and tell me I'm wrong, because you are going to be in for a treat with this car. And it feels really well put together. That's another thing. The seats are incredible on the Macan S. And the GDS, not so great on the Macan. Comfortable, but I felt the Macan, the base or the entry level, lacked a bit of bolster because it was capable. It's a four-cylinder, right? The other two are twin-turbo sixes, 2.9 sixes. But the four-cylinder even sounds good, which I thought was really good. And you can really tuck into it. But obviously, you know, you get out of the V6 and step down to the inline four, and you think, it lacks that real talky feeling that you get from that six. It's a brilliant engine. And to answer your question, I don't think there was much that needed. It actually feels more responsive now. Throttle response feels sharper, and steering, I think, has been worked a little bit. Just a marvelous vehicle when I was really shocked when I looked at the competitive pricing and it found it to be the cheaper amongst its performance rivals, which you know, not much more they can do with that. But again, I haven't done a like-for-like on options and all that, so perhaps the rivals have more kit as standard. I don't know, but Porsche are notorious for charging a lot of money for silly things, you know, 600 for this, 400 for that, stitching 600, you know. Seats are really expensive when you start upping the ante in seats in Porsches. So, but again, you don't have to. Don't look at the options list. That's my advice.
So, Croft, you know, it's one thing to have great ride and handling and engaging drive experience, but one thing that I was really interested reading about in your review, and something that we all noticed when they released the updated Macan images, is that the interior has been not overhauled, but, you know, revised quite a bit. And a lot of the switchgear is not switchgear anymore, and it's more touch capacitive stuff, which we're seeing a lot with the premium segments, particularly within the Volkswagen Group. And something that I know from my time with the Tiguan, with the Touareg, with various Audi models, is that some of these touch capacitive controls can be quite tricky to use. And I consider myself a very tech-focused young lad. For someone of your demographic, and I'm not trying to be derogatory. For someone like yourself, and or you think of a Porsche buyer of your demographic, where I feel like the general customer base is a very traditional old school, you know, they prefer physical buttons that click and, you know, really direct lines of feel through all the different controls. In terms of though that aspect of it, because, you know, you're going to a lot of people who buy Macans will drive them to and from work every day. So how did you find using these new interior elements how do you think somebody who may not be super tech focused will be able to use these day to day?
Good question. There is volume dials, and there is still the toggle switches to increase or decrease the ambient temperature with the AC. So you've still got that. Some cars don't have that at all. Look, you're right. Some of those haptic things you've got to press twice. I've not found that to be any different in any car, no matter how much the price. They all are a little bit fiddly. I think the Porsche version is actually some of the more robust of that style of, you know, when you get into the reduction of buttons. I found it I got used to it in minutes. You've still got a proper large shifter. So that's good. I'm basically used to the little Porsche 911 shifter as well.
All right. Well, the Porsche Macan got a Car Expert rating of 8.5. You can see it now at the site. Thank you, Tony Crawford.
Thanks, guys.
Well, that's the end of the Car Expert podcast for 2021. We will be back, as you just said, Scully, bigger and better than ever next year. It was a busy week the past week with some events. Obviously, it's taking a little bit of a break going into Christmas, but what did we get up to?
So we spent Monday – I spent Monday driving the Nissan GT-R T-Spec at Sandown. I can't tell you what the car's like to drive, just that I'm smiling right now as I talk about it. And Mike was with GMSV. And then Paul's actually out at Lang Lang today filming that GT-R T-Spec in Millennium Jade, the green. Ooh. We've also had people in the past couple of weeks doing everything from driving the Maserati MC20 to covering Toyota and Volkswagen news briefings. So as we've come into the end of the year, it's been busy, but it looks like the calendar is clear between now and when we finish up next Wednesday, which is a bit of a relief.
Nice. And I suppose, Shay, we're going to go through the Christmas car calendar now of what cars people will be taking away for the break.
Yeah, so it's a bit light on at the moment, and I don't actually have anything for myself yet, but who knows, maybe I'll do some road tripping in the Gulf because I haven't done that since we've been in lockdown for half the time I've owned it. Mm-hmm. But in Melbourne, we've got a Kia Sportage S, we've got a Hyundai i20N, which Scott is very excited to take away for 2 weeks, and Paul Marich is in the Porsche Taycan Turbo, and Moco is in the updated Isuzu D-Max X-Terrain. Croft has got himself into a six-cylinder Range Rover Velar, which I'm sure will be very interesting. And up in Brisbane, the guys are in a Kona N and a Mercedes E350 Cabriolet. So really interesting cars and a decent mix of things. For me, I will either drive my Golf or I'm trying to find like one of those off-roady wagon types. I'm hoping for like an Audi Allroad. That's the dream. Maybe I'll try for a Passat Alltrack or something, because I'm going to like Lake Eildon and then up to Yarrawonga, which is sort of very, some people won't even know where that is on the, who are listening, but sort of like very regional places that might require a little bit of ground clearance. But I do enjoy having something that's sort of compact, still fairly low to the ground and fun to drive, but also being a bit more practical for the odd speed hump or gravel road or whatever. So we'll see what happens. Otherwise, it would be great to take the Golf out for a week or so and travel the state that I haven't been able to explore for the last 18 months.
How many Ks have you done in that? It wouldn't be many.
Since I bought it, I think I've done, I think it's about to tick over 22,000, which is about 18,000 since I bought it.
Oh,
which
okay.
Is yeah. All right, considering, you know, I'm in and out of press cars and I haven't been able to drive a whole lot in lockdown. So, yeah, it's decent, but my next service sticker says like 35,000 kilometers or the next 12 months, so I'm a bit behind that.
Alrighty, that is a wrap. Thank you so much for listening over the past 12 months, or if you've been listening longer. Scott Colley, James Wong, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mandy, thank you for hosting the podcast for the past 12 months. It's always a joy to see you on camera, and hopefully we can do this more in person next year.
Wouldn't that be lovely? And to our listeners, I hope you have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And if you are spending time on the road over the break, please drive safely.